In violation of international law, Russia held sham presidential elections in the occupied territories of Ukraine. But this was far from the only violation. The terrorist attacks against Ukrainian cities continue. Meanwhile, several European intelligence services warn about the possibility of Russian aggression against the West. You're listening to the podcast Explaining Ukraine. The Explaining Ukraine podcast is produced by Ukraine World, an English language website about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yarmolenko. I'm a Ukrainian philosopher, journalist, and chief editor of Ukraine World. I invite you to a regular conversation between my colleagues Anastasia Herasimchuk and Daria Sinayevska, journalists and analysts at Ukraine World. They analyzed key events in and around Ukraine during the last week. Let me remind you that Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. Let me also remind you that you can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. We provide exclusive content for our patrons. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode.
For 3 days, from the 15th to the 17th of March, the world was observing a mockery called presidential elections in Russia. The process was going amidst election law violations. Apart from that, we all know that there was no real opposition to the newly elected president of Russia, and there was no access to free media and real media coverage of these elections. The result of so-called elections is that Putin has become a new old president of Russia. And before he starts his new tenure in power, he has been in power for already 24 years. But these violations were not the only ones. Russia has also violated the international law by conducting these pseudo-elections on the occupied territories of Ukraine.
And except for the mockery itself, a significant crime was committed during these so-called elections, that they were held and forced voting in temporarily occupied territories of Ukraine. And as Ukrainian journalists have reported, according to official data from the occupation administrations, 320,000 passports were allegedly issued in the bombed out and burned out Mariupol. An incredible and obvious fake number, but you might wonder which purpose stands behind these numbers. Basically, it provides a justification for the fraud to pump up the turnout figures. And we know that more than 50 UN member states have condemned the so-called presidential elections held by Russia in the occupied territories of Ukraine. Russia used various techniques to show loyalty, loyalty that doesn't take place in territory of temporarily occupied parts of Ukraine. And it involved violations in the Ural regional center of Yekaterinburg and the city of Artemivsk, Sverdlovsk region, because Russians arrived at the polling stations and they found out that they had been disconnected from their permanent residence in order to vote in the puppet DPR, Donetsk Public Republic, and Zaporizhia Oblast of Ukraine. And therefore, these votes of Ural residents will be, as we know, they did statistically count it as votes cast in temporarily occupied territories of Ukraine. We also know that Ukrainians who refused to participate in pseudo-elections were detained, and such detentions were recorded in Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson oblasts. And the detainees were taken to the occupational police stations, where they wrote explanations, you know, to the occupiers about why they would not participate in these elections. And according to sources, there were 249 such cases of detention, after which the occupiers began to conceal the information. In addition, unlike the September elections, you remember the one that were held for local authorities, the occupiers increased the number of security forces during early voting. For every member of the so-called election commission, there were up to three security forces who controlled voters during the voting. In order to artificially increase the turnout at the these so-called elections, the occupiers resorted to innovative attempts. For example, they launched like five buses with signs on them polling stations, and as soon as the driver saw people at the bus stops, the like bus stopped, and people were forced to take part in these elections. And for the first time, the occupiers decided not to transport those people to like polling stations, but simply sent security forces and members of election commissions to the enterprises where they forced everyone to vote on the spot. So during both early and general voting, members of this illegal election commissions and occupational security forces supervised people who voted. At some polling stations, we know that soldiers entered the places where the voters were supposed to indicate their will and to have a vote. Russians delivered a ballot box to homes of Ukrainians at temporarily occupied territories, along with soldiers with machine guns, and shamelessly, Putin told, "I thought that the turnover would be good, but I didn't even expect them to be like this." So we know that Putin continues and plays along with this Russian sentiments to Stalin, who once said, "It doesn't matter how they vote, it matters who counts." See, you almost can sense this Orwellian motive. Like Putin's party in power has even introduced a special electronic like application for gadgets for voting, and using it, voters have to report their choices via geolocated text messages. And another trick was to, you know, extend the voting period to 3 days so that they covered a working day, which is Friday. And like election chats were set up at various enterprises to give instructions on how to get off work and go to polls in order to vote. So along with simulating support for Putin in temporarily occupied territories, one might wonder, what does the totalitarian regime need for these elections? And here I can say that autocrat relies on the support of the so-called selectorate. He's not interested in the opinion or positions of the majority of voters. In non-democratic regimes, this selectorate is defined as those who are willing to support the government for personal benefits. And those personal benefits can be of various nature. It can be money, career opportunities, or even the absence of direct repressions, which are widely popular in Russia. In this type of voters, the ruling regime relies on its personal political preservation rather than some like democratic values. And we know that under the model of this so-called electoral autocracy, elections turn into a kind of rite of passage for the nomenclature. What does it mean? It means testing the electorate for its ability to preserve the status quo and thus strengthen and reproduce the power of the permanent leader. So it's not a joke, and I want to be extremely clear here. We see that for a while the Eurosceptics far movements gained support in search of a firm hand, a leader of a steadfast will. In Russian case, there is nothing to brag about. It's about revival of totalitarianism. And it's real. I mean, if we take the basics of political science, totalitarian regime is the regime of transformation of classes into the masses, displacement of the party system with central support for power structures, with its fragmented but still ideology, which in Russian case premises are like necromantic adorance of Stalin, what in Russian they call Tsari Bozhe, that means the merge of civil and religious power, and thus everyone who is against Putin is perceived heretic. Who is against the God?
Indeed, what you've just told, Dasha, is something like unbelievable for people who are used to live in democracy and for people who live in states where the law is obeyed and where the law is respected. So while looking at what was going on at this during these so-called Russian presidential elections, it's difficult to believe that it's not like a comedy show or absurd movie, but that's the reality. And what is extremely shocking here is that people in Russia do not pay attention to these kinds of violations, and the majority of Russians just take the reality the way it is without asking any questions and without putting these results under question. So they are actually happy with their choice, even though the real numbers, like the results of the elections, were actually rather drew by the Russian authorities. They are not real, but still people do not ask any questions. And talking about the, I just want to add some thoughts about what was going on in the occupied territories of Ukraine. If we heard about some cases of sabotage of elections in the Russian territories, I mean, these were just sporadic cases when some people used Molotov cocktails or something like that to disrupt the process, which didn't have actually any real results. Like, these were isolated cases. In the occupied territories of Ukraine, people who are against occupation, who are waiting for the liberation, who didn't want to take part in these elections, they couldn't take any kind of actions like that. They couldn't show their resistance, they couldn't show their unwillingness to vote, because they are under grave danger, and if they did so, the consequences for them might be tragic. And if we talk about the results of these so-called presidential elections in the occupied territories, like, the outcomes for these territories might be even worse than the outcomes of the occupation itself. What I mean here is that this imitation of legitimacy of current Russian power, because, like, one of the aims of conducting these elections in the occupied territories was solid legitimization of Putin's rule over the occupied territories. So after that, after the imitation of the fact that Ukrainians in the occupied territories supported Putin, he has his hands even more free to act the way he wants. And some analysts predict that after the elections, the repressions might become even more massive and even more cruel. And we know about the fact that people from the occupied territories are forcefully mobilized to the Russian army. So after the elections, this process may get even more intense. And talking about the violation of international law by Russia, I want to move to another instances of how Russia violates this law. And I want to talk about the difficult, tragic topic about Russian attacks against Ukrainian cities. And we talk about it quite often, and we tell you about the devastating effects of Russian missile and drone attacks on Ukrainian peaceful cities. So sometimes we don't tell about it, especially lately, but even though we don't do it, it doesn't mean that they stopped. Ukrainians are suffering from constant attacks, but the cruel reality is that lately we just think about if it's worth mentioning or not, and we select, like, the most devastating attacks. And, like, sometimes we just don't talk about those cases, those attacks where just several people died or were killed, or only premises like buildings were damaged. And that's actually very scary. It's terrible reality of the war, because like we just don't tell about small amount of casualties, but even one lost life, even, I don't know, several wounded people, it's already a tragedy for the country. This week, the last week was marked with tragic events, and that is why we are raising this topic. Even though they were regular, let's call it regular attacks by Russian forces on Ukrainian cities, where as the result of which like not a huge amount of people suffered, like for example a drone attack on Vinnytsia, where a drone hit the residential building, apartment building, and three people were wounded, or a drone attack on Sumy region and on the Sumy city itself, under which three people were killed and 14 wounded. They were more massive and brutal attacks. And here I want to tell you about the bloodiest and very treacherous attack on Odessa, which took place on the 15th of March. So Russia used two ballistic missiles to hit a residential area. And as a result of this attack, 21 Odessa residents were killed and 74 were wounded. And I will not even talk about the damage caused to buildings, because in this regard, all those buildings, infrastructure, aren't of paramount importance. The tragedy here is the number of lives lost. And what is the most treacherous and brutal about this attack, that the Russians used the double tap tactics. It means that they launched the first ballistic missile, and after some time, they hit the same place with the second ballistic missile. The aim of these tactics is not only to kill civilians and cause huge damage to civilians, but also to kill those people who are rescuing civilians. And these tactics worked perfectly well for Russians, because they killed not only residents of Odessa, they killed paramedics, police officers, rescue workers who came to the site of the tragedy to help those people who suffered from the first attack. They were also coping with the consequences of the first attack, like firefighters were trying to cope with a huge fire that was in one of the buildings that was ruined after the first attack. And this place actually was a residential area, and there were no military objects nearby. And this statement I've just made, it's not new. I mean, every time Russia hits Ukrainian cities, there are no military objects nearby. But in this case, like, there is no place even for speculations about possible possible presence of some military objects, because I live close to the place where this happened, so in Odessa, and I know this area very well. And the attack took place like very close to the big park I usually walk in, so it's just 10 minutes walk from there. So my personal experience was quite painful, but just not to get emotional and not to talk about this painful experience, I just want to state that no military objects are there. It was Friday, it was a working day, and the attack took place closer to noon, to the noon. So there were lots of people outdoors, some people were at their homes, and that day was rainy in Odessa, and even though I didn't, of course, I didn't go to the place of this hit, missile hit, I saw so many photos and videos online, and it was a rainy day, as I've told, and there were literally rivers of blood on the streets there where the missile hit. So people were just doing their business, going somewhere. By the way, there are several schools and the kindergarten close to that place. Luckily, no children suffered. They had these several minutes to hide in the basement, in the bomb shelter. So luckily, they were all safe and sound. So Russia doesn't stop shocking Ukrainians and the world in general by these brutal attacks. And they show that what they can do very well is to fight with civilians. And this attack on Odessa actually wasn't the only bloody one. Lately, especially over the last week, the Sumy region, and I mean the areas of this region that are close to the Russian border, are severely suffering from Russian attacks. The border areas or areas that are close to the front lines always suffer from Russian attacks, and the Ukrainian authorities call on the local population evacuate from those areas. But I'm telling about bigger extent of these attacks, because what is going on there now is something much more severe than what we are used to. So the local authorities and locals say that actually now Russia is erasing territories of Sumy region that are close to borders. Only on the 17th of March, the residents there heard about 500 explosions. Russians dropped 200 aerial bombs, and that's an immense amount. Even though the evacuation started earlier, not all the residents of these places wanted to leave their homes, and now they have to do it under the constant shelling, and Russians are using all the possible means to erase those territories from the surface of Earth. They're using attacks from air, they're using ballistic missiles, so everything they have in their hands they are using to destroy lives of Ukrainian people and to take their lives. And some military say that the Russians are destroying Ukrainian population as a revenge for their failed initial attempts to take the whole Ukraine. So that's the position of coward and evil power. And there is, unfortunately, nothing unexpected here. But still, even though everyone has already understood what the Russian nature is, all these losses, all these tragedies are a huge pain, and this pain gets deep in our hearts.
And speaking of deepening of pain, we also have to acknowledge that the only right way to pay off this pain is to attack this dictatorship in a manner that it would not be able to pursue its interests, and because its interests is of imperial nature. It's not about telling this or that state what to do. It's about stating that there are sovereign states with their legitimate powers and their plans for the future. And you cannot ever, ever attack sovereign state and attack its population, its borders. And in terms of this passage, we have to also look deeper into the situation on the front lines. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine reports that over the past day, 72 combat engagements took place between Ukrainian and Russian troops. The Russians lost 19 tanks, 17 armored vehicles, 34 artillery systems, and other equipment. So the fighting remains fierce, and you can imagine what are the powers involved in this battle. Our defense forces repelled attacks at various directions near Kupiansk, Koloman, Bakhmut, Avdiivka, Novopavlivka, Orikhiv, and other directions. And Russia is deliberately launching a wave of rumors about a new offensive in Sumy and Chernihiv oblast, but the threat is constantly being observed, the situation is being monitored, and the border is being strengthened. The representative of the Defense Intelligence of Ukraine added that in view of the hostilities in the Belgorod and Kursk regions in Russia, the invaders are trying to shift the focus and disseminate information in their own interest. And I shall remind that on 12th of March, a new operation was launched in Russia by military units opposed to the situation which unfolded in this state, including the Russian Freedom Legion and Russian Volunteer Corps and the Siberian Battalion. Most active area is Novopavlivka, which is west of the town of Marinka, where the enemy has been concentrating its main efforts since the Ukrainian troops withdrew from Avdiivka for understandable purposes. Also, Robotyne in Zaporizhia has become a principal target for the Russians. Although the enemy is throwing, you know, significant resources and fighting against, you know, Robotyne, they suffer very heavy losses there, but do not give up their attempts. And we see that the Russians are switching to the tactics of small assault groups. At the same time, you see this Robotyne place is almost destroyed, but it remains under the control of Ukrainian troops. So again, the situation at the front line remains tense. And in such harsh conditions, both sides are trying to find the means and solutions to achieve their superiority. And Ukraine pursue attacks on oil facilities, and these attacks are quite an effective tactic, in part because petrol prices can be a political problem for Putin. And this again circles us back to the idea of vulnerability and anticity of targeting resources which are vital for dictatorships. A series of strikes on the most powerful oil refineries in Russia has become a new campaign of Ukraine, and this topic is being discussed throughout Ukraine, Western media's expert circles. Overall, in 2024, there were 15 drone attacks on 13 oil refineries in 9 regions of the Russian Federation, and of these, 8 facilities sustained significant damages. It is estimated about 600,000 barrels of Russia's daily oil refining capacity has been knocked out by Ukrainian drone strikes. So this moves us to the idea that we are now trying to cut off these resources, because we understand what it means to witnessing the war, the long war. And as soon as the world understands that, and we see those narratives that are being on air, and that this idea of a dictatorship that has to be cut off resources is on air, and it's a positive sign. But again, cutting resources now is about restricting and limiting the powers, the military capacities of Russia. Because we see the rhetoric of that side about partitioning of Baltic states, partitioning of Poland. Now it tries to partition Ukraine's territory. So in all those narratives, we see the main motive, the motive of war against NATO.
Indeed. And when we talk about the Russian rhetoric, we should understand that, yes, it might be only rhetoric, but there are no guarantees that these are only empty words. And as we see in case of Russian aggression against Ukraine and before Russia launched its aggression against Ukraine in 2014, there were cases of Georgia or Moldova. So we know the aggressive nature of this state. And it means that Russia isn't only threatening, Russia is able to attack. Even if it's like Russian leadership can say whatever, they might say that they would never attack anyone. They might say that they would destroy the whole world. And that's only about rhetoric. But we need to look at the actions. We also need to understand this mechanism of how aggression works and how the appetites of an aggressor grow. So the aggressor understands only the power. And if you show the weakness, then it might let the aggressor think that he has his hands free to do whatever he wants and he will not meet the proper response. That is why these talks in Europe about the proper response to Russia, about the readiness to protect themselves, about the understanding of this grave danger is extremely important. And even though it's quite late, it's still not too late. I mean, if this understanding came to minds of European leaders earlier, the devastating consequences might have been avoided and Russia wouldn't adapt to the new reality that fast and effectively. But still, it's better to understand it and get ready for the possible Russian aggression than to keep ignoring these facts. Putin might prepare the attack on the NATO states already in 2024. That's the information from the German intelligence service analysis. And according to the sources, Russia is getting ready for a fundamental conflict with the West. Quite alarming, isn't it? And the reorganization of Russian army, the movement of its troops, missile deployment on its western borders are actually the evidence of Russia being in a state of getting ready for something big and serious. And if Russia continues these actions and keep their pace, it might double its military capacities over the next 5 years. So if Russia don't attack all the NATO states, or if Russia doesn't attack the western part of Europe, it doesn't mean that it will not attack separate states, especially in Baltics or in the Eastern Europe. So the Baltic states, Finland or Poland, are under the biggest danger from Russia. So if Russia doesn't attack directly or immediately, it doesn't mean that it will not attack asymmetrically and after that attacks directly. And these asymmetrical attacks is what the world has been observing for long years. And without going to instances in history like interference with elections or sending spies to the Western state, I just want to mention the current example of this asymmetrical threat. While quite recently, the Russians were testing their electronic warfare systems in Kaliningrad Oblast, and they weakened the GPS signal over NATO states, which resulted in problems for NATO air forces. So it's quite a telling example of what Russia is capable to do. The Estonian intelligence drew the same conclusion as the German intelligence. And according to it, Russia is reorganizing its army for conflict with NATO. And according to Estonian intelligence, this conflict is possible during the next decade. What is important here is that Russian military leadership drew lessons from the from their mistakes in the war with Ukraine. And Russian military adapt to current reality unexpectedly fast. Unexpectedly fast is actually what was told by Europeans. It's not my phrase. And I just want to emphasize this unexpectedly part, because actually Ukraine was warning the West about Russian ability to adapt to current reality, about Russian ability to avoid the negative effects of sanctions, about Russian ability to invest everything in the military sphere at the expense of normal standards of life of their citizens. And what we are seeing now, what we are observing, is actually what Ukraine was warning about. And now Russia has raised its military budget and they increased the number of soldiers. The military production companies are working like the whole days, nonstop, to produce as much weaponry as possible. What is also alarming is that even though the Russian main tactics of waging war is quite old and Soviet style, they are fighting with heavy weapons and their people, they are launching meat grinder assaults, still taking into account those mistakes they made on the battlefields in Ukraine and taking into account the necessity of changing certain tactics in the modern warfare, the Russians are also working on the developing modern technology, and they are working on creating the whole robotic systems to deploy on the battlefields. And these systems wouldn't require soldiers' presence, actually, and it's also very alarming, especially for the Western states. Earlier, some European media told about the Russian threat, and that's actually started from the very end of 2023, and the similar warnings were also disseminated in Western media in January 2024. So, for example, the German media Bild, referring to some European intelligence sources, said that Russia might attack Europe already in the end of 2024 or in 2025. And the analysts and the representatives of intelligence told about this period, said about this period, just because they are looking at the events that are going on in the USA. So the USA is in the election period, and according to those sources, Russia might use the transitional period in the USA after the election. So when the newly elected president hasn't taking its power yet, and the previous president is leaving his position. So this interim period might be favorable for Russia to launch some aggressive actions. And in the same period, it was the end of 2023, the beginning of 2024, the head of the NATO military committee, Admiral Rob Bauer, said that Europe should get ready for the total war with Russia. And in the same manner, the German defense minister Boris Pistorius told that now Europe is facing the biggest threat over the last 30 years, and the Russian attack is possible within the next 5-8 years. So we see that the European leaders, the NATO leaders, understand the real danger. And according to Ukrainian analysts and military, Europe doesn't actually have 10 or 8 years. According to the estimates of our military analysts, Russia might be ready to attack within the next 2-3 years. And To draw this conclusion, it's necessary to understand the very nature of Russian state and the Russian people, because these people are ready to suffer any deprivations. They will lack the financing of education, healthcare. They will suffer from low standards of life, but they will invest everything, every possible effort and all the funds to increase their military capabilities. And that's what history shows to us. So to understand the severity, the seriousness of this threat, it's just necessary to observe. It's necessary to understand the Russian actions, to understand the nature of their state, and to look at the historical examples. And it is necessary to act until it's not too late.
This was a podcast explaining Ukraine by Ukraine World, an English language website about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yermolenko. I'm the chief editor of Ukraine World. This was a regular conversation between my colleagues Anastasia Herasimchuk and Daria Sinayevska, journalists and analysts at Ukraine World. They analyzed key events in and around Ukraine during the last week. Let me remind you that you can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode. Stay with us and stand with Ukraine.